We're here to talk about the greatness of the Fabians, right? That's why you invited me on, right?
How fabulous they are.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Wolves in sheep's clothing.
So what is the Fabian Society?
Yeah, it's an important question, and it is one that I would have woken up at any time to speak about if you had told me that there were listening, thinking people wanting to learn about them, because it is so very important, not just for us here living in Commonwealth countries, but which is sort of the home base where this grouping, this, I guess you could call it a think tank. You could call it that if you want to, but it's much more than that, as people have probably already figured out on their own, which we're about to reveal in the course of today's brief discussion. But it all of humanity, you can't understand anything that went awry in the last 120 or so years if you don't take into consideration in a very serious way the issue of the Fabian Society. So what is the Fabian Society? Well, the Fabian Society, as you pointed out, today is a very influential network. I would say, to get across some nuance, not everybody who has been in the Labour Party or even necessarily who has been a member of the Fabian Society, is implicitly aware of the operation. I've seen a lot of evidence that over time, good people have found themselves operating within that if they want to exert political influence, if they identify themselves with the left. And by that, I mean the left in the best way of the term, anti-imperial, in favor of justice, labor, the poor and the rights of the poor. I mean, these are basically human things. Mm-hmm. I don't even want to call it left, but it's just that's sort of been the domain that the so-called left has occupied, as representing those interests for the past, 152, really since the French Revolution, I suppose. But the categories sometimes betray reality, as we also know. So all that to say, just because somebody is affiliated with the Fabians doesn't intrinsically make them bad. However, the agency itself is toxic. It's very toxic. So I'll say a little bit about its origins and its purpose, and then we could see where we want to go from there. So it was founded around 1884-ish. It was founded not as an isolated thing in a vacuum through the inner sanctum of the British Empire, although it was an English institution that did emerge within the British Empire, that did create certain agencies that are very influential today as far as indoctrination centers, ideological control centers, like, for example, the London School of Economics was their official university, founded in 1897 or so, to promote.
Hold on. You can't talk about a respectable, further higher education institution, a world-class university as the LSC, as an indoctrination center, is there to teach people about economics and stuff. What are you talking about, Matt?
That's an interesting thing, right? Because almost everybody will agree that our whole economy has been getting worse and worse and worse as our societies become increasingly this rapacious bubble of debt-based usury and speculation founded on nothing. Mm-hmm. So everyone will kind of typically, unless you're really, really, really high as a kite out of reality at this point, they'll acknowledge that the economy globally has been run in a retarded way consistently to the point of breakdown. And they'll also acknowledge that we're producing a lot of PhDs in economics, and we've been doing that in an increased number over the past 70, 80 years. But they won't often put two and two together that maybe whatever the hell we're giving to these PhDs in economics and micro and macro who are going off to shape the economy might have something to do with why the economy has been destroying itself and destroying humanity, right? They don't make that connection.
Matt. By the way, I am going to interrupt Matt because I want to dig into this, right? But also I want to make sure that I understand these concepts and other people understand these concepts. And I can see a parallel, it never occurred to me before, with what happened with the capture of medicine. Mm. How the Rockefellers captured traditional and destroyed traditional medicine and replaced it with pharmacopoeia, which hasn't resulted in people being healthier.
Right.
And one of the ways they did it was through the capture of educational institutions to promote how we could use these pharmaceutical products to alleviate our symptoms versus addressing the actual root cause and then providing Rockefeller with another income stream for his hydrocarbon products. So great I point. Can now see that as a parallel with regards to the whole institution of economics, because one of the things that they don't teach in any of these financial universities, as far as I know, is the American system of political economy.
No.
They don't teach about the value of gold and silver as money.
No. No, they don't. No, they don't. And that's by design, right? So there are certain sets of ideas that have been provably a threat to the systems of oligarchical parasitical rule. And in more recent history, the expression of these types of very powerful ideas that are founded and grounded in natural law, provably so, had emerged in the wake of the American Revolution within an already existing, it's not like it completely originated out of a vacuum with the American Revolution, this American system of political economy that you have referred to, but it was a breakthrough in an already existent movement to, you know, that had formerly taken the character of the French dirigist school of Jean-Baptiste Colbert, the great French finance minister who created a proto-American system type of economy vectored around changing the nature of credit into a productive from a war-driven speculative asset that's designed to be a cover for an extractive system of parasites in war and plunder. He converted that the treasuries of France into something qualitatively different that redirected through the Peace of Westphalia the new type of credit towards the finances within the treasuries, the tax base, the revenue base of the nation, into investments into the general welfare through things like the Midi Canal, these major mega infrastructure products, of which there were hundreds in the 1660s, 70s, 80s, 90s through France and beyond. And it spread. Earlier, it was known as the Cameralist tradition that grew out of the Golden Renaissance, the best of the Golden Renaissance. So it has precursors. And this is where, if you read the writings of Alexander Hamilton, he's directly referencing Colbert and the need to study the Colbertist dirigist method of directed credit, where you allow for the blossoming of the private sector at the same time as the society as a whole co-developed. It's not like one or the other, like the state or the individual, which is the dichotomy that's been imposed in the 19th century to the present. Like, you have to pick one. You can't have both. The Fabian Society were major players in promoting, exacerbating that false dichotomization, which you do not get with this American system that blends the harmony of the whole with the well-being and freedom of the individual. A lot of it's cultural too, and that's something people have forgotten about. The Fabian Society, so what they did, here's the thing. So to understand the Fabian Society, it's all about context. That's why people sometimes get frustrated that I don't often answer a direct question, but take my word for it.
I understand the value of context. I completely get it. The context completely shapes what shows up in the foreground.
Yeah.
People can get it. If I walk into a house, which I do as a social worker, right, and there's a dog there, you won't find me touching the dog. I'll move away from the dog. I'll ask the owner to take the dog away. You might assume, oh, Rich is scared of dogs. No, I'm not scared of dogs. I'm a Muslim, and dogs are unclean for Muslims. So that context makes all the difference. Now, if there's a cat, oh, come on. I want to stroke that cat. Send it over here.
But, right, well, so, what if there's a cat that thinks he's a dog? Like, my cat thinks he's a
dog. I don't mind.
Okay, all right. Oof,
I don't mind. I don't mind trans dogs.
Right, you're not woke. Your identity. What you identify with, that's right. Define what you are, right.
Cat is woke. It's a trans dog. Anyway.
Oh, yeah, I love
context
that.
Context is
totally right.
Really, really important.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So here's the context. The Fabian Society, like I said, emerged in 1883, 1884. Within what context? So the world at the time, what's shaping the British Empire? What's shaping the world? The world is being shaped principally by this positive spread of the American system of political economy, both within the USA that had just recently survived its very existential civil war, but also internationally, where this system that Lincoln had died for, and that was being spread by Henry C. Carey, his leading advisor, who organized the Philadelphia Centennial Exposition in 1876 to celebrate to the world the success of this particular method, which was very clearly defined as opposed to the British definition of political economy of the school of David Ricardo, Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, Malthus, who were all recognized as being just simply assets of the British Empire as slaves and devoted promoters of the structures of sin of the empire, using the cover of legitimate scientific economics language. But it was recognized as being a false system. And the proof was in the pudding, because not only did America survive, but through the application of the protective tariff, the focus on productive credit emitted towards internal improvements that were designed to increase the productive powers of labor of that society, both in the whole and also for the individual laborer, and specifically the increase of new discoveries and inventions. That was the key thing that Lincoln, Carey, Hamilton all focused on, is that the source of value doesn't come from the markets per se, although we allow the markets as a necessary point of competition, that's fine. But you don't brainwash yourself into thinking that the desire of the supply and demand cause value, that the value itself is rather located in the power of the human mind to make discoveries and inventions that are applied in ways that improve the society as a whole. That's where the wow. nexus, right? It's very clear when you read the writings of any of these key figures who brought this forward. They're very, very unambiguous about that understanding. And so that was spreading to France in the 1880s, 90s through the figure of President Sadi Carnot, who gets assassinated in 1895 when he's applying this to great benefit. In France, you have it in Audubon Bismarck.
This French president who wanted to apply the American system of political economy in 1895 in France got assassinated. And just like Abraham Lincoln, who wanted to apply the American system of political economy, got assassinated. Just like President McKinley got assassinated. And from my limited understanding of JFK, he wanted to bring this about, and he also got assassinated. I wonder who by.
You see, I'm a coincidence theorist. I reject all patterns that you just said. Everything should be isolated in a vacuum myopically.
Okay.
Disconnected from everything else.
Yep. And Trump wants to bring about the American system of political economy because he keeps referencing McKinley, and he wants to bring in tariffs and empower the productive capacity of the American people. There's no assassinated attempts on him. None. So.
Yeah, and I hope his understanding of it is clear. I'm waiting to see if he's got the proper understanding of those words that he's using, but so far so good. The word for the, as far as that goes, he's doing well.
Yeah.
So why am I saying? So not only in France did you have this being spread, but also in Germany with the formation of the Zollverein, the customs union applied and developed by Audubon Bismarck, utilizing the studies of the American school thinkers like Friedrich List, who brought this into Germany, modeling these designs on what Hamilton had done to unify the nation after the American Revolution. That was exactly what was applied in Germany under Bismarck. You had it in Russia under the networks of Alexander II, who had earlier saved America during the Civil War and applied this system of protective tariffs by the figures of, for example, Count Sergei Vita, the finance minister in the 1890s and the first prime minister, who was working with Mendeleev, the great scientist who discovered the periodic ordering of the elements. So he was also on the committee of the protective tariff, who came to Philadelphia, that Mendeleev, and then returned to Moscow to apply this system in organizing the industrial development of Russia. As you pointed out, McKinley also was a follower of the system in America. And if you look at it, most of the people I'm talking about here on my short list did get either overthrown by intelligence operations or just outright murdered by intelligence operations that were running anarchist terrorist cells around the world. These were also being directed by, well, who was controlling the international anarchist terrorist networks? Well, you got to go to the first international anarchist conference in London in 1871 to get an appreciation for the British intelligence controls of this international web of incubating useful idiots. Yes.
No, not London.
I know. So out of character. I know. No, I'm sure that's the one bad thing they did. I'm sure everything else is fine.
No, it's certainly not the city of London. I'm sure nothing bad has ever sprung from there, ever.
No, never. No, this is, I'm sure, a one-off. So anyway, that happens to be where they were located. And all that to say, you had this spread where nations were beginning to recognize the evil of this empire, the British Empire, being something that had spread itself far too thin, had begun to seriously find itself weakening after it had organized these very disgusting wars with China, the Opium Wars 1 and 2, the civil war in China that the British had also orchestrated, that was happening during the Second Opium War, that people were all looking at in horror at what the British were doing there under the guise of free trade, you know, bringing in massive drugs into China under the context that, oh, but you signed a free trade agreement. That means you can't use national protection against the influx of, you know, opium that we've got. By the way, where did we get it? Oh, from India, that we destroyed their textile mills and took control of their economy for 80, 90 years before that. so that all that India was allowed to do to have a revenue stream was produce opium, because we cut off the hands of all of the, you know, the actual textile workers and destroy their factories to subdue them. But now they can make drugs that are going to be sent through the organized crime of the triads and the green gangs and the Freemasonic fronts that the British had created inside of China, in Hong Kong and Shanghai and other things, to destroy the spirit and the minds of the Chinese people, while at the same time reinforcing this organized crime syndicate that becomes, you know, essentially the deep state of China for the next century or more.
Okay. Now, hold on. So what you're saying is what the British did through their proxies is, and their agents around different parts of the world, was produce fentanyl and then seep it into the United States in order to destroy the spirit of the American people and empower their own proxies within that nation in order to subvert any independent sovereigntist spirit of anyone who would want to reinstall the American system of political economy. Did I hear you right?
I guess you could read it that way if you want, sure.
well, it's just like patterns, isn't it? It's the same game.
It's the same formula. Yeah, the recipe book is not that complicated at the end of the day. When you get at the inner formula, that's the formula is pretty simplistic. They add complexity to it so that people find it daunting to try to unpeel the layers of the onion. But if you approach it in a top-down way, like it's the same formula. So this gets us actually at the Fabian Society, which uses a formula that has worked for 2+ millennia. So everyone's waking up to the evils of the British Empire. The Empire's in a crisis. They realize that they've shown their cards, their evil cards, way too much, and they need to change things up if they're going to be able to snuff out the flame of sovereign national development that's happening around the world. It's that big of a deal. It's like a real existential moment for the empire itself. So there's essentially a period from the 1870s until the 1890s of serious kind of like corporate self-examination of the empire to figure out, okay, how do we recalibrate what we're doing to undo the danger of all of this goodness and progress that's happening? So one of the things that they do, there's, I would say, a number of core new think tanks that emerge into the public light in the inner sanctum of the empire. Number one, out of Cambridge, which is sort of the core center command of the control over ideas of grand strategy. This is places like the Cambridge Apostles play a big role in shaping the top down ideological structures of the empire. Then you have Oxford, and you have what becomes the London School of Economics that shape principally the tactical doers who are designed to do the dirty work of infiltrating and undoing nations that are targeted for destruction. So the first thing you have in 1865 is that, again, Lincoln has just been murdered. The Civil War is just over. And the first thing that is set up 1865 is the X Club out of Cambridge. And you can't understand the Fabian Society if you don't first understand the X Club. So the X Club is spearheaded by a figure named Thomas Huxley. And what it aspires to do is essentially control the levers of scientific knowledge in every field of science imaginable that should be redefined in a way that interprets, whether it's math, physics, biology, economics, you name it, like any field, geology, has to be reinterpreted from a Darwinian interpretation, which is what Huxley's primary role had been for a couple of decades earlier, is handling and managing the figure of Charles Darwin and the ideological system that Darwin had packaged that was designed to promote a notion that creative discoveries are not something that we find either in human beings or in nature more broadly or in physics, that ultimately everything must be assumed to change according to gradualistic adaption only, that ultimately at the heart of this gradualistic adaption, says Darwin, of the emergence of new living species and the disappearance of other species is a randomness function, that there's kind of like a rolling of the dice mutation system that gives certain species the luck of being able to have more sex, kill better their enemies, eat more, and thus be more adaptive, but ultimately governed by an irrational randomness function. That's another Trojan horse embedded within Huxley's Darwinian system. And again, I say Huxley because I don't even know that Darwin, who never was permitted to even defend his ideas in public, I don't even know to what degree he was fully aware of his own ideas. But it was also designed to defend the notion that that the British Empire and systems of empire are the most natural mode of organizing society because they're founded upon a notion of might makes right.
Yeah, and the strongest of the fittest,
right?
Absolutely. It is a truth universally acknowledged that the British should rule everyone.
Yeah. And the ultimate empirical data to justify that thesis that the empire promoted is that, well, look, we're the empire in which the sun never set. Look what we've done to subdue the inferior races and peoples of the world. If we were an inferior, it would be the black and the brown and the yellow people who would have subdued us. But because we subdued them, that is sufficient proof that their theory is justifiable to be spread as the only way you can interpret the evolution of species, ignoring all other anti-Darwinian interpretations that existed, acknowledging the changing evolution of nature, but that incorporated things like purposefulness, harmony, intelligence, design. All of that had to be discarded in favor of this particular interpretation that the X Club made the sort of enshrined new religion, out of which things like geology, the Lyell mode of interpreting geological epochs had to also impose gradualism, even though we find actual evidence of quantized cataclysms that periodically shape geological epochs. That was discarded in favor of this gradualistic idea. The same thing for Darwin. Like in fossil records, you don't find gradual small changes from species to species. What you tend to get are, going back in the fossil layers, whole systems of life having gone through ruptures that cause a completely new system with higher attributes to emerge. And we don't fully know all of the dynamics. A lot of this probably has to do with certain metaphysical principles, certain magnetic properties that deal with the galaxy as the whole. There's so many questions to be investigated that you're not allowed to investigate if you follow the X Club redefinition. And so what was happening was...
I'm going to interrupt you. If I can interrupt you, watch me. I can. Look, I just did.
Right? Well done, sir. Well played. Yeah.
Excuse my very polite English syntax. Right? Excuse me, sir. Okay, so Thomas Huxley wasn't a scientist. He had a particular political, cultural agenda.
Yes.
And he was a member of the X Club.
Founder
of the X Club. So there was a guy, I forget his name, who was a member of the Club of Rome, who wasn't a scientist, who then came up with this particular notion of how, and we've got to be careful here, of how carbon dioxide behaves and what it does to humanity and the planet, and how that whole model permeates the political sphere in order to organize society and money and politics in a way that serves the oligarchs that were members of the Club of Rome. Have I understood you correctly, Matt?
You're drawing your patterns quite well. Yes, that's right.
Another coincidence.
Yeah, it's never about the one thing, right? There's always the oligarchy thinks in a dynamic, holistic manner, although it's perverse. So it's important for us to also not like think at least on that level of dynamism, but then also a little bit better, because the oligarchy is still missing certain marbles that they need to properly understand what it is that they're trying to influence. So hopefully we can go there. And that's where it's useful to look at, like, what is it that Huxley, who, like, you know, you pointed out, he's rewarded with a little mini dynasty. He didn't come from a rich high blood family, but he makes a point that one of the problems why the empire's got itself into the crisis that it faces in 1865 is that it was too rigid. It didn't allow for the fluidity, the adaptability that was necessary to incorporate fresh new minds who might not be part of certain high bloodlines. And so in order to have the type of creative rejuvenation required and flexibility, they needed to loosen up a little bit and look for talent. Like he's talking about himself. You know, he's like, hey, let me into the inner club. Like, I'll work for you. I'll be like you. yeah. Let me in. But he's making a point. It's a solid point he's making. And he's got a sardonic, vicious, cynical wit, very powerful wit that makes him very useful at destroying his enemies. And he begins to frame public debates, organizing media outlets to cover in the press in those days, the debates that he usually has with highly religious, incompetent opponents who he chooses to represent the anti-Darwinian Christian matrix, which is typically the most radically rigid, absurd opponents who he knows he's smarter than. He can easily eviscerate their positions. So this is part of the propaganda of what gets the public mind to turn. Now, part of also that idea if you look, is to justify the science of eugenics. And whether it's Galton, Sir Francis Galton, who's a member of the X Club, or Herbert Spencer, another member of the X Club, both men found two different expressions of the human social application of Darwin's system of the survival of the fittest, whereas Galton is a more centralized version of it, of eugenics, the science of breeding out and the unfit in order to create a new type of humanity based upon the most fit managing the least fit. Or Herbert Spencer, who creates a false opposition, basically saying, no, you don't centralize it. You simply allow free markets everywhere to express the power of who has the ability to destroy the obsolete people through the markets. And you let that just organically, it's more libertarian friendly way of doing eugenics. And the weak will be destroyed by the strong in time organically without mandating it from any central position. But the core assumptions were identical. They're the exact same core axiom. So it was a very controlled fake opposition. You know, it's like Keynes versus Von Hayek, you know, pick a Malthusian. Both, you know, pick one. Both of them ultimately believe in Thomas Malthus. They both believe in Bernard Mandeville. They both believe in a society organized by world government, just in different, with different flavors that creates the illusion of a debate that's being organized by, in the 1930s, the London School of Economics, which we'll bring up, that'll come into play here. So what do we have is now, this requires political application. Once you have the general framework, intellectually speaking, that's trying to impose gradualism, randomness into various fields of study, now you need to do it. So you got the pure, now we got the applied. The applied requires now certain headquarters, domains by which a reschooling of both the existent managers, civil service can have their skills and appreciation for the strategy owned, and also new blood. They're thinking multi-generationally. They can't get their way now. The momentum and the belief in the goodness of human beings, the goodness of God, the belief that we can always have more people at a higher quality of life by encouraging new discoveries, that renders Malthus obsolete. These can't be, you can't put that genie in the bottle. They're beginning to realize they have to take a longer term view of themselves and society, both allowing new blood. Right, they have to allow new people, maybe not from the high classes, but who have a devotion and a creative power that's vile. Like H.G. Wells comes into play as a poor person from a gardener's family who's brought in because he has the skill, like Huxley does, who trains him. By the way, he's the teacher of H.G. Wells, Thomas Huxley, at the normal school in England. But then you need institutions to do it. So now you have two institutions will be created in the coming years that both operate from one, Oxford, which is the what becomes known as the Milner Cecil Rhodes Roundtable Movement, which we could talk about in the future episode, but it works in tandem with the 1883-84 Fabian Society, which is organized by a bunch of misanthropic eugenicists who realize that they need to accommodate the new spirit of defending the poor, of labor unions that are beginning to organize to give individuals the means of projecting power and defense and even offense against the rapacious structures of the imperial capitalist system, which had used the cover of capitalism in order to have child labor, slave labor, 18-hour day work. I mean, you know, read The Tale of Two Cities. It's there's some real stuff in there. So they have to accommodate that, but they have to take possession of it in order to ultimately redirect it towards an orientation that will benefit the empire in the long run. So they all begin to promote systems of organizing society around socialistic language, utilizing some of the elements that they liked from Marx. Marx, by the way, being a creature who was based in England at the London Museum is where he did all of his writings. He had two managers in the form of Friedrich Engels, who seems to have done more of the work than even Marx did, frankly, the way I look at it. And also David Urquhart, who was a high-level British grand strategist at the British Museum, who played a key role in managing Marx throughout all of his time in England. So it seems like, just like Darwin had handlers through the figure of Thomas Huxley, it seems like Marx also was a useful asset who probably didn't even fully write most of the things we assume that he wrote. But the fact that he published, or his Das Kapital was published in England first in 1865, volume one, then volume two in 1868, and then volume three in 1871. But why 1865 does he publish these things? He published these things at that time because The American system is spreading around the world, and the empire recognizes that if you can't beat it, co-opt it and destroy it from within. So what Marx is doing, he's writing for the, and this is going to come up for the Fabian society structures to understand it, because they're nominally driven by promoting a Marxist type of social organization at first. Mm-hmm. So you can't understand why they're doing that unless you understand this other part of the plan earlier on. So Marx is writing for the New York Tribune in the 1850s and early 1860s. You're like, why? Well, because he had certain anti-slavery tastes, and which were seen as beneficial to promote by those in the North during the Civil War and before the Civil War that were useful. But it was it wasn't realized that he was learning, or at least the people working with Marx were learning, how to map out this American system of Carey, who was in correspondence with Marx, because Carey was the editor-in-chief of the New York Tribune that was employing Marx in the 1850s. Now, Carey, who becomes the leader of Lincoln, the organizer of the American system internationally, he's somebody, when you read his writings, anything of value that one might find in Marx, including the critique against capital imperialism, or imperial capitalism, which was the British East India Company, didn't come from Marx. Actually, Marx acquired it, stole it from Henry C. Carey. Carey's understanding and promotion of the science of increasing the productive powers of labor, which you'll find in Marx, was actually stolen from Carey, repurposed, and then inserted into Marx's system, which it's like, yeah, no shit, right? Like, of course, you should be always trying to increase the productive powers of society. That should be a no-brainer. It doesn't mean that you should also abandon the idea of private property and God and like assume a class struggle forever. Like, there's no need for those toxic Trojan horses that you get with the Marxist interpretation. Other things too, like Marx's refutations of Thomas Malthus. It's like, yeah, those are good. Those are good. Thomas Malthus is incorrect. Marx is right. But did Marx actually generate those proofs? No, they were already existent and highly published in a better form with more reasonable foundations in the form of Henry C. Carey and his father, Matthew Carey, which you can get by reading The Harmony of Interest. You could read it by 1851. You could read his Science of Political Economy books that were widely read. So all that to say, Marx's Capital is essentially a Delphic hodgepodge of extracted, stolen ideas, repurposed and repackaged with a bunch of sick, disgusting concepts that cut people off from the actual American system. So it's got a surface appearance, can't beat it, co-opt it, you know. And that's what the Fabian Society makes their mandate to organize their new school that becomes set up around the London School of Economics to accommodate people who are more anti-imperial, who have a little bit more heart, you know, intact, a desire to defend the poor and unions, and then try to basically brainwash them to think that the way you do that is you have to adopt a Marxist dialectic materialist framework in order to do all these other, which if you do that, your capacity to actually carry out the fight that you want to carry out will be undermined completely. You might have a good intention, but you will lack the intellectual understanding of the thing that will make your fight possible by design.
Yes.
So the fact that these people like George Bernard Shaw, Beatrice and Sidney Webb, later on H.G. Wells, Lord Halford Mackinder, the founder of modern geopolitics, are all members of the Fabian Society. Lord Bertrand Russell, who's a high-level multi-generational oligarch, who's also a member of the Fabian Society. Sir Julian Huxley, the grandson of Thomas, is a member of the Fabian Society. Lord Maynard Keynes, Fabian, right? So many people who become top-down influential grand strategists are both Fabians, who care about the poor and, you know, social justice so much, and at the same time, misanthropic pro-eugenicists who despise the poor and want to reduce the world population under some eugenics high priesthood.
Sure. But Matt, you must understand, yeah, they're doing it for our good. They're doing it for the good of humanity, so that's okay. You know, when they chopped off the hands of the Indian laborers, they were doing it for the good of the Indian laborers. And there's probably a pattern like that in the last 5 years or so, where they offered us got to be careful because of the census, a particular medical intervention for our own good. So, you know, we've got to be grateful for that. I do see another pattern of how, and my understanding of this is fairly superficial, of how the British fostered Christian fundamentalism, Islamic fundamentalism by promoting Wahhabism during the time of the Ottomans, and Zionism in order to remove people from the actual nature and spirit of the original Abrahamic traditions that those three are born out of, so that we end up going in this other direction where we end up fighting each other versus uniting against our imperial overlords, who actually just want to, they're out after our best interests anyway. Who needs, who needs hands?
It's a super good observation. You're right. And yeah, like, it's true. The source of, like, the worst expressions of Christian fundamentalism, Christian Zionism, Jewish Zionism, like you pointed out, very astutely so, Wahhabite fundamentalism within the Muslim world. You can't account for the emergence and the spread of any of these ideologies that are so rigid and that are so useful if you want to create forever wars and divide to conquer strategies, if you don't look at the influential role of British grand strategists who permeate, you know, the civil service of Egypt, of target countries of the Ottoman Empire earlier. And, you know, people like Anthony Norris, the founder of the Plymouth Brethren, that is sort of this Jesuitical Anglican subcult in 1829. This guy is in charge of the British Empire's missionary services into the Ottoman Empire throughout the 1820s, 1830s. And his job is to ingratiate himself into the various courts of the Muslim Empire, the various influential networks of the elites, and to, on the one hand, get intelligence for the empire that he's devoted for under the cover of missionary work. And on the other hand, to look for talent who will be granted scholarships in Cambridge, in Oxford, from amongst those of the high noble princes and families of the Muslim world, and then who will be, after sufficient brainwashing has occurred, sent back in order to manage the British Empire as local, I guess you could say, house slaves, right? The same kind of principle. So then
what they did, these oligarchs that you referred to earlier, they took talent that they found and they fostered it through institutions like Oxford University and the London School of Economics in order to bring about a particular political economic system that was a counterpoint to the American system of political economy. So people wouldn't use that method because that method undermined the whole operating model of the British Empire and globalism.
Well, yeah, that's right. It's a controlled opposition. And if you look at the British Empire, it justified its power of economic terrorism and exploitation through the figure of Adam Smith, who was, again, a devoted figure to Jeremy Bentham, who sponsored much of his original work on the theory of moral sentiments, as well as The Wealth of Nations, published in 1776. And part of the Smith service to the empire was to justify why the American Republican, no colony should ever have the right, or it would be the most unnatural thing for nations to put protective tariffs on, to infringe upon the freedom of the markets, to self-regulate with hidden hands, and that the human mind, as Smith directly says, should play no role in determining the long-term purpose and course of that society, that's the domain for God to concern himself with. And Smith is very clear in his theory on moral sentiments, which is still taught in universities, that the purpose of mankind is to occupy himself with the avoidance of pain, the pursuit of pleasure, the attraction of the two sexes, basically sex, and everything else will kind of just work itself out. Now, if you believe in his system and apply it, you will always weaken and destroy your nation's ability to have industry where there was none. You will not be able to defend yourself from things like the City of London or the British East India Company. But so that becomes then a counterpoint to Marx. And now Marxism and the Marxist interpretation becomes the only thing you're allowed to use to try to fight back against the Smithian, Ricardo, you know, British Empire school. But it's a false opposition. They actually have the same organizing principles, ensuring that anybody who plays that game will not be able to avoid becoming a slave of the empire. This is similar to the formula that Huxley had organized between the Darwinian school and the radical Christian fundamentalist school, that everything was created at the same time 7,000 years ago with a literal interpretation of the Bible. And then you say, pick one or the other. There's no other choice but one of these two extremes, or later on the von Hayek versus Keynes debate. Either you're a statist or you're radically individual. Either you believe that only the general welfare of the whole matters and not the individual, or you believe that only the individual matters and not the general welfare. Pick one extreme, and if you play that game, you're screwed. So, but the American system school, which is not premised on either one of those extremes, that is foreboding. You're not allowed to allow that type of thinking into the discussion because it liberates people from the dualism. So this is what, you know, these Fabians are doing. Now, one of the reasons why they call themselves the Fabian Society is that they were using their studies of ancient history, specifically the Roman Empire, before it became an empire, it was sliding into imperialism still. It was becoming corrupt. And the thing that was leading that corruption was Rome's backstabbing of its former ally, Carthage, which had a 200-year alliance with Rome until the first of the three Punic Wars that Rome launched against Carthage. In the second Punic War, which again, I'm not saying Carthage was good. However, they're not the ones who started that fight. They were not culpable for that, but they were doing a better job, especially under Hannibal, of beating back the Roman Empire. Hannibal was a very creative maneuverist, and it was only with the emergence of a figure named Fabius Maximus, who was an oligarch. He'd formerly been consul, and he was made effectively tyrant of Rome and assigned the task of coming up with a new strategy that would save Rome, which was clearly, like the British Empire in the late 19th century, Rome was clearly going to fail. It was just not working. And so his solution was a new method of slow attrition, of never taking on the enemy head on, always doing small guerrilla tactics and then retreat, try to waste away your enemy by, causing their supply lines to slowly fall apart, get them to just get exhausted. And then once they're fully exhausted and spread too thin, then you strike, which is part of the Fabian Society logo with the turtle saying, I take a long time to strike, but when I strike it, I strike hard, or something like that. You know, it's kind of a funny logo that goes with the wolf and the sheep's clothing. Now that did end up working. Now the Fabian Society that utilized that idea said, okay, we're going to take a more Darwinian, gradualistic, multi-generational approach instead of trying to get satisfaction too quickly, but we'll work with seemingly rival think tanks that are going to incubate and brainwash young elites from around the world in Oxford. And that'll be that's what becomes the Roundtable Movement. Both of them and the leadership of both agencies both talk about how they're modeling their systems off of the Jesuits and the Jesuit Constitution. So that's something to think about and to chew on for people out there, what that means. But they're both using the same techniques, although they're nominally rivals, right? Like one is coming out of the leading killers, the sociopathic young men of around Lord Milner, who came into manhood overseeing the Boer War mass murder of Boers in South Africa. That was a terribly genocidal war that originated concentration camps that took the war to the women and the children. And that's where Milner's kindergarten, his grouping of young sociopathic men like Leo Amery, being one of many of these groups, came to prominence, learning the ropes of basically how to do killing. They're the leaders of the Roundtable Movement. So the Fabians and the Roundtable are working together, one taking cherishing the power and strength of the masculine energy of the British Empire and stiff upper lip to impose its will of the strong men onto the weak savages. You know, I get that sort of thing.
You're so well, Matt.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I specialize in evil British villains. I can't do the British sound nicely, though. I always just sound like a villain of some sort or another. Or then you have like the heartfelt response, which is the empathic Fabians who create the labor movement, the labor party in 1901 or 1902 to be their political expression. The Roundtable Movement ends up creating things like the Rhodes Trust and the Rhodes Scholarship Program to begin an indoctrination of young elites, first from the Anglo-Saxon world, and then they spread it out to allow for darker skinned people to also get brainwashed and sent back to their parts of the world over time. And on the surface, again, like I said, they appear to be rivals, but you'll find these points of conjunction, like Lord Milner Milner with the Roundtable Movement, working with Halford Mackinder, who's directing the London School of Economics in 1905, 1906, to work together at that time where both men, under the Rhodes Trust money, come together to Canada to figure out a strategy to keep this McKinley system from spreading and uniting North America, which was the case with Lincoln admirers at that time under Sir Wilfrid Laurier, the Prime Minister of Canada, who was trying to do just that very thing that had to be thwarted, which is what Milner and Mackinder, representing the two seemingly opposed factions, were working to do. And they did that to great effect, unfortunately. Okay. Other cases we have in Canada was the creation of the Canadian Labour Party, or that self-consciously called itself the Canadian Fabian Society. Who sets this thing up in the middle of the Great Depression? Well, the literal name in 1931 when it's created is the League for Social Reconstruction. But if you look on even Wikipedia, who are the founders of the League of Social Reconstruction? That is the Fabian Society of Canada that professes to create a new scientifically managed society as the solution to the Great Depression. It's five bloody Rhodes Scholars. It's like five are the founders of this left Canadian work, like this recalibrated Cape Fabian Society for the Canadians. So they're clearly always actually working together, or the emergence of the later Club of Rome. The Fabian Society had, and my book series goes through this in a pretty good amount of detail, both the Untold History of Canada, four-volume book series, as well as volume two of The Clash of the Two Americas. These organizations directly were responsible together, the Roundtable Movement of Rhodes Scholarship Zombies and the Fabians, which includes Pierre Elliott Trudeau, among many others, were together responsible for setting up such things as the Club of Rome in the 1960s in order to recalibrate human society around a neo-Darwinian reinterpretation of mankind, premised around effectively a new Gaia cult of protecting humanity from, or protecting nature from humanity. Alexander King and others are directly patrons of this process, this perversion. And so I would just round it out with that directly impacts the world that we're living in today.
Yes, and I can see that because our overlords, I mean, the whole conversation or the meme that we are the human beings of the virus, yeah, versus no, actually, we're just as much a part of this planet, this ecosystem, as anything else. And that if we're a virus, then we need to be reduced or eliminated. And one way they're going to do that is, we'll own nothing, and that will make us really happy. I can't wait to own nothing. And because that,
well,
make
don't
me
you
happy.
Feel so sad when you have something that you owned and that you lose, dude, it, and it's taken away or it's stolen? Well, imagine it if you never have to experience that sadness of having something you own stolen or taken away or lost ever again.
Do you know what, Matt? I've got this custom built bicycle, 21 years old.
Yeah.
It's fabulous bicycle. It's wonderful. I'm just going to leave it unlocked somewhere because then I'll be happier.
You will. You'll never stress about breaking it, about scratching it. No,
I'll walk everywhere.
Yeah.
<That's right>. I'll walk home now. I'll just leave it outside and walk home now. Matt, it's
been, I'm sure you can rent. You could rent another one that looks just like it from somebody who does own it.
Yes. Matt, I'm going to have your links in the description below. It's been really, really great talking to you. Absolutely fascinating. You're a fabulous, fabulous teacher. And what's really great is there's all this stuff that has been deliberately obscured from our view. They don't want us to know this, which is why it's imperative that it's this sort of information that we find out about and share with others. So thank you so much, Matt. Until the next time, which, by the way, won't be long. Everybody, please share, subscribe, comment, contribute to this conversation as well. And between now and when I see you next, everybody take care. All the best. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.